speciale della 14ª Biennale Internazionale d'Arte di Carrara.
Sitting here in a destroyed office in an old marble, well, I suppose carving factory in the center of Carrara. We're really surrounded by rubbish, by the collapsed ceiling above us. It's a beautiful day and the sun is coming through very dirty windows, but we can hear the sounds of the city outside.
Anthony Gromley, Carrara, ex laboratorio Corsi Nicolai, 26 giugno 2010. Riflessioni sulla scultura, non monumentale, inerte e silenziosa, e che tuttavia innesca nuovi rapporti timici e temporali con lo spazio che la ospita. Da One and Other, Another Singularity e Two Times Two, il lavoro realizzato per la Biennale di Carrara.
I've installed a work called Two Times Two, a newly made but not humanly touched carving that uses the very most recent possibilities of digital design to instruct a five-axis router that has managed to carve down to a resolution of 0.3 of a single millimeter, a nesting polyhedral space evocation of the place of the body twice. So we are using the most advanced technological means to make something that in a way has the longest history in the making of sculpture in, I guess, the anthropological kind of history of making bodies. I think of bodies as being in art almost as long as they have been conscious. And people have been making stone bodies that outlive their own for maybe 15,000 years. These two are 1.93 meters high. They are more or less my height because they're derived from a digital mapping of my body. I was molded, positive blasters were made, and those positive blasters were then scanned by a laser scanner. And my body was turned into a topographical map of 30,000 digital coordinates. That wire was then used as an enclosing domain into which around 80 nesting polyhedral forms were created to occupy the volume that my body displaced. I suppose I'm trying to think again about how to make a marble carving in the 21st century without any of the illusionistic representational affects of, say, Renaissance carving, but at the same time dealing with the body. And I think it is the body, not a figure. You have to imagine these two standing forms that are absolutely identical, that have been mechanically produced, standing in the destroyed main studio of a factory that in the 19th century probably would have employed 200 or 300 employees, manually reproducing funerary monuments of crying angels, St. Andrew, crucifixes, the whole panopticon of Christian iconography to do with the consolation of death. This great studio is now completely destroyed, and huge blocks of marble covered in dust, the destroyed archive of the factory itself with its account books, its manuals on carving, half-finished crucifixes, bits of plastic, the rotting supports and carving stands of the workers, the overhead compressed air system that in the last phase of their work here powered their air tools. It's a space that's maybe 40 meters long, 17 meters high, and 12 meters wide. And the two forms are about 12 meters into the room. The room is very well lit with windows on two sides, but most of the glass is missing. You can hear the sound of birds, swallows and swifts that have nested in the rafters. Everything is covered in grey dust, except for these two forms that, because of their polyhedral surfaces, catch the light in very different ways. And as the sun makes its journey from east to west, the works increasingly become illuminated from the side, and at night at about 7:35 they receive the full light of the evening sun on their left flank. The idea is really to think about what this material is. Marble is a metamorphic limestone. Limestone that has changed its chemical characteristics through pressure and heat. Calcium carbonate is one of the forms of carbon that extends the carbon range. You could say that we, as living beings, are also dependent on carbon chains. Calcium carbonate, the form of marble, has a very particular crystalline molecular structure. And it's this internal materialist anatomy of marble that I have used as the primary reference point in evoking the body in this extraordinary place, where bodies, in some senses, were made to do a very particular job of mourning and memory.
I think there's always a risk, isn't there, when you take over a historic context, that it's going to win. I mean, it's very difficult anyway, I think, to use stone without being archaic or somehow falling back into old ideas of humanism, of man as the measure of all things, of man as the pinnacle of creation, all of these things. And I guess for me, I was trying to really polarize the idea of the historic and indeed romantic decrepitude of this location with something much more contemporary, hard, in a way chemical and scientific, but most of all new. You know, the whiteness of the new marble blocks standing in the greyness of this destruction, you could say, chaos of history. But it's up to you to decide whether, in a way, the building of itself is more interesting than using it as a frame. Or using it, I don't think of it as a frame, actually. I think of it as really part of the work. We've done a lot of, in a way, composition with rubbish. Yesterday when I arrived, there was a clear path that allowed them to install the work front door. But I felt that this was very crude, and we had to unify a kind of sea of chaos out of which these things arise. And I hope that we've done it well enough for it to seem like that's the way it always was. But I have worked, I'm feeling that I'm working very much with the material of the context as part of the work. I like churches, even though I'm not a believer. There's something about the way that churches, in a way, even more so now, are redundant spaces. They are in the world, but not of it. They are a place where you can go and think about things, where you can abstract yourself. And I think maybe that's the atmosphere that drew me to want to use this place at all. The idea that it's fallen out of history. It's no longer a living space. It's kind of in the world but not connected to it. Anyway, for better or for worse, the use of a real space for imaginative purposes, for the, in a way, this is a physical environment, but we treat it as a reflexive space. I think that's about as interesting as art can get these days. But I ought to say something about this idea of post-monument. I mean, obviously, what distinguishes what I have made downstairs from a traditional statue is it's not mythological, it's not part of a narrative, it's certainly not a known, it's not a representation of a known icon or real political figure or even real personage. It comes from a lived moment, so these are two renditions of a single
moment of lived time. So it started with me being moulded in that position. But it really doesn't matter anymore whose that body was. It represents the place where a body once was, and in a sense anybody could be. But that place has not been articulated or made to carry symbolic, iconic, narrative, or any form of attribute. So we are left with this crystalline ghosts in this abandoned factory. And I think the idea really is through the presence of these things that talk about reproduction, talk about the body, but also talk about the material of marble, to involve us in becoming conscious, in a way, protagonists within this context of the demise of, it's really the demise of a whole, what could we say, use value of art. You could say it's the demise of religion. It's the demise of the consolations that religion gives us in terms of death. It's the demise of, in a way, the idea of the great tradition that starts with Pericles and kind of carries on to Rodin. But this is absolutely and completely finished. So the function that art has today is of a fundamentally different order. Rather than reinforcing the known and giving us a sense of history that is given often by political hierarchies or by the victors, the function of art today, I think, is to express a degree or to encourage a degree of disorientation, of displacement, of uncertainty, in order to reinforce the subject's self-determination. And this is really important. So far as I'm concerned, the beholder's share, the viewer's participation in thinking about what is this place I have come to, and what are these objects doing in it, and how do they work together, and what is my presence doing within this field of activity. That's really important to me, and what we end up with is something much more open, something where the value is very uninscribed and uncertain too. The value really comes once the viewer begins to think about, in a way, the implicit subject matter that maybe they bring for themselves. Time is absolutely part of the, if you like, responsibility of sculpture. Sculpture is about making objects in time. It demands a multiplicity, I think, of temporal responses to fulfill that responsibility. There's the time, the present time of the viewer, which is maybe the most important. But there's obviously the time in this work, the capturing of the lived time of the performative element, which you quite rightly say is perhaps the most important part now. The truth claim, the reality claim of this work is that it comes from a real body in real time that really happened. So this is not expressionist. This is evidential. This is forensic. This is evidence of something that really happened. But of course, it's not enough simply to say, well, all I'm trying to do is transfer to the present time of the viewer the past time of this action. In a sense, sculpture also, and this is true of its fundamental nature, is about making a marker in time. And this has to do with the relationship between biological time and other times, which might be industrial or geological. So for me, sculpture has always tried in some way, and you could say in its Ur condition or its fundamental necessity, to inscribe in times that are not as fast as human time, whether that's in a way electronic communication time or biological time or industrial time, something of human thought and feeling. And that's exactly why in megalithic times, the early farmers thought it was a good idea to take a stone that was unmarked and dormant and part, as it were, of the texture of the received world and stand it vertical so that it becomes a marker in space, but also a marker in time. And often that marker in time related to sidereal time, related to the movement of the planets. That function of sculpture to relocate the present time of a conscious human with deep time, I don't think it has changed. And you might say, well, yeah, but the performative element of contemporary art in trying to hold up a mirror to our own experience has to use multi-layered narratives, has to use multi-screen projections, has to use immersive environments that use sound and moving image. But I would say that this is, in a sense, simply an extension of contemporary multi-layered experience, that we are, in a sense, becoming more and more adept at the hermeneutics of daily life, in which we read a symbolic meta-language constantly and orientate our behavior within it through those readings. And I would suggest that, you know, sculpture, if we can find a way of using its silence and its stillness and its atavism, is actually a huge relief from that need to read, to orientate, and to in a way locate ourselves multi-layeredly in a symbolic universe. You know, for me, the material language of sculpture is an incredibly important palliative resistance to, and in a way relief from, the symbolic order of contemporary life. And in that sense is always going to be slower, older, you could say dumber, but I think dumber with purpose. In other words, it's not about what it has to say, it's about the kind of spaces that allow us to feel things that otherwise we couldn't. This work here, 2x2, the second body is us, is the viewer, is those who are not the object. Obviously it deals with all forms of alterity, whether it's to do with the perfect copy or to do with the clone or to do with the other. But I used the same geometry in the work that I made in Beijing with Arte Continua, which was called Another Singularity. First of all, the body size was expanded to 5x life size, and then every vertice at the corner of the polygons, which were described by silk-covered rubber bungees, every one of those vertices was connected to the architecture. And it's a very, in a sense, this is a diagram of what I'm hoping is happening downstairs. I want, in sometimes referencing the body, but certainly in activating a space, which might be by 5 kilometers of metal rod, or it might be by the placing of a couple of crystalline marble pieces within a context, I want in some way to activate the space so that the viewer's body becomes conscious of their movement through space. So this uncertain floor that we've got here, that is made up of spongy material and then glass, broken marble, bits of wood, immediately you have to be careful, you have to be aware of your passage through space in a way that you're not when you are on a, you know, flat, well-cleaned, well-polished floor. The idea of transferring, and transference is very, very important to me. There are many forms of transference. I would say empathy is the first. There is the place where a body once was. There is the place where I too could be. So this idea of projection, the projection of subjective experience onto this object. But then I think there are other senses of transference. There's an implied instability within the poses of these two works, which I hope is a reference to the fact that as you come into this space, you are uncertain about the status of anything, how, where you can go, what your relationship is to this ruined building. And hopefully, I mean, you know, Joseph Beuys used to call it thinking with your knees, which is a lovely way of just saying transfer may be the visual command system that is always trying to interpret and read environments to something else, which is just in a way about first-hand experience. I mean, this is the thing that's so precious, I think, these days. We're so good at reading that we forget to enjoy just the sense of moving over soft ground, for instance. I've just been up in the mountains in Scotland, and firm ground is firm ground, but it's rare. You know, you stand on a rock, because most of the time you're standing on moss or peat or heather. And as you move across space, your body is reacting constantly to a total sensorium of
in a way, invitations to reorientate your internal sense of balance, your appreciation of, you know, wet and dry, the direction of the wind, all of those things. And I think that the strange thing is sculpture in its inertia, in its uselessness, can be a catalyst in exactly the same way that a chemical catalyst is non-active, but it is the trigger that allows us to be more aware of our own aliveness. I could say that every invitation to come into an exhibition space is a sort of an agreement to enter a place that has been articulated by a particular vision or a particular mindset or whatever. This question really is twofold. One is about, in a way, the political dimension of art and to what extent art can test, extend, and confront our freedoms or lack of them. And I think then the second part of the question is really to do with whether actually this old dialectic between private and public any longer pertains, any longer is useful. Because the degree to which our minds have themselves been branded, and that we have accepted in fact the loss of what I would consider real public space, is the degree to which we are all immersed again in a hermeneutic or symbolic order in which branding and commercial interest, political pressure and indeed propaganda are absolutely immersed in our daily lives. We don't think twice about the fact that our shoes have what is essentially an external tattoo that allows us to feel part of something. Whether we acknowledge that or not, these are forces that are in a way demanding conformism to forms of exchange, to an embeddedness within a fairly depersonalized zone of branding. In other words, the choices that individuals make are less and less about individual choice. What I hope that one and other was doing was, in a way, more crude things, which are simply in a place of nationalism, defined very much in 18th 19th and 20th century models of victory, of the male general, naval officer, civil servant, who has been recognized as defending national values and is now given a place in our kind of hall of the heroes, to within that idea of nationalism that accepts a degree of hierarchy and accepts a degree of exploitation, to put in a way the vulnerable and very fugitive and provisional idea of the self. The extraordinary thing was how many of them decided that they were going to perform to character, and that actually, you know, maybe this is part of our present mindset, that actually we don't feel as individuals that we can be actually simply ourselves for others. I would say over 50% of people were acting out characters that they felt would be appropriate to that public space. And it was actually the rare ones that simply went up there and either talked about their lives. I mean, they were, for me, the most potent and moving. I mean, people who went up there without a microphone, but using the natural PA system that we gave to all of them, and simply talked about their experience of being isolated in that public space. People who had maybe lost a loved one felt very upset about being divorced from somebody they'd lived with for a long time. I'm not saying that the whole point of One Another was an exercise, in a way, freedom of expression. There's no way that I could, you know, characterize one thing as being more valuable than another. I think we have to take the whole project as a, in a sense, collective portrait of a time and maybe a people, because it did turn out to be very English for whatever reason. I don't know why. I mean, it felt like something that might have happened, you know, in a little village, fate, but there it was happening in the middle of London. I was very encouraged because I think that in a sense it was an experiment to see whether the space of art could be used as a test site for identity in all its latitude. And we've just finished the book, and it was a really difficult thing making a book. It's a big book, it's 700 pages. And we have tried in a way to show the width of response to this idea of using this old mid-19th century frame, you could say a plinth is a frame, as a test site for contemporary desires, fears and amusement. Because there's no question that a lot of people went up there simply wishing to amuse themselves and maybe a wider world. So it's another, it's another one of my experiments. This is an experiment. I think of all of my work as very experimental. It's every time I think of something to do, it's more or less starting again. And that was certainly starting again. And the implications that it has for the rest of my work are still, I'm still digesting them.
Radio Papesse.org